The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, March 11th, 2024. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
a pending change to city rules could end the annual Memorial Mile.
Tyrol Basin hosted its annual pond skim this weekend, a bit earlier than usual due to this winter's mild weather.
A candidate in the race for Dane County Board says rural communities need more support.
And in the second half, a conversation with Jill Stein, the anniversary of a momentous speech from President Truman, and a movie review. This is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news coming to you live from the WORTU studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are your headlines.
President Biden is all in for Madison's bus rapid transit. Madison could get more than $118 million from the federal government to support bus initiatives in the city after under a 2025 budget proposal released by President Biden today. The money would help support a line to connect the north and south sides of the city, the second phase of Bus Rapid Transit, or BRT. The federal funding would cover more than three-quarters of the project's costs, reports Channel 3000. It's about the same number that the Federal Transit Authority has already given to Madison for the first leg of BRT, which will connect the city's east and west sides. The first leg of the project is slated to start near the end of this year. Of course, Biden's budget proposal still needs congressional approval, which is likely to be an uphill battle. Meanwhile, President Biden is slated to make a campaign stop in Milwaukee this Wednesday, a week after Vice President Harris visited Madison to tour, among other things, a new facility for the city's bus fleet.
The Wisconsin Elections Commission will meet tomorrow to decide whether or not a recall petition against Robin Voss, one of the top Republicans in the state legislature, can move forward. That's after organizers submitted paperwork to the Election Commission today saying they've gathered the requisite number of signatures to force a recall election against the Assembly Speaker. The recall effort comes not from liberals, but from conservatives upset with Speaker Voss's approach to elections. Racine County resident Matthew Snorick, who delivered paperwork this morning, told reporters that a top issue was Voss's blocking of a move to impeach the state's top election officials. The top official would be the Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf. Voss has said his position for 11 years has held his position for 11 years, making him the longest serving assembly speaker in state history, reports the Associated Press.
In local education news, the Sun Prairie Board of Education is slated to meet tonight in their only regular board meeting this month. And tonight, they're slated to vote on whether to adopt a new language arts curriculum, reports Madison 365. The curriculum, developed by a Virginia-based nonprofit, is aimed at enhancing phonics education, but it also contains some language and imagery offensive to Native Americans. Meanwhile, in the Madison Metropolitan School District, the Madison School Board and union representing thousands of MMSD staffers have made their opening budget gambit. The teachers' union is asking for the maximum base wage increase allowed this year and an increase of 4.12%. When asked by the Cap Times if the union would settle for the 0% increase initially proposed by MMSD, Michael Jones, president of Teachers Inc., or MTI, told the reporter, quote, God no. A district spokesperson told the Cap Times that the initial offer is the opening move from which, quote, negotiations can spring, unquote. The school district is slated to announce their budget proposal next month.
Madison election officials worked through the weekend to ensure a timely mailing of absentee ballots, according to the city clerk's office. That work continued today as roughly 100 poll workers gathered at the Madison Municipal Building to prepare 13,000 absentee ballots for mailing. We are just over 3 weeks away from the spring election on April 2nd. Don't procrastinate mailing your ballot back. It can take about a week for ballots to travel through the mail, and all absentee ballots must be received by Election Day to be counted. You can track the status of your ballot at MyVoteWisconsin. That's myvotedo.wisconsin.gov. When you head to that website, you can also see what'll be on your ballot this spring, no matter how you choose to vote. Aside from the presidential primary, there are a number of down-ballot races you could see, like local alder, county supervisor, or school board candidate. All Wisconsin voters will see two constitutional referendum questions related to election administration.
Grizzly bear sisters at Henry Vila Zoo have officially emerged from their hibernation, according to an announcement from the zoo today. The zoo says grizzly sisters Ash and Lexi have spent the last several weeks coming out of torpor, the first step of exiting their winter hibernation. The sisters made their first appearance 2 weeks ago in late February. It's the earliest that the grizzlies have ever woken up, says the zoo. And that shorter hibernation could be a reflection of a warming winter. Late last week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that the U.S. as a whole had its warmest winter on record. Wisconsin and other Midwest states recorded their warmest February on record since the agency started keeping track 130 years ago. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Nearly every year on Memorial Day, Veterans for Peace Madison places thousands of tombstones along Atwood Avenue to represent the human impacts of war. But that tradition may end this year due to a proposed change in city park policy. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the story.
Since 2007, we have been installing what we call the Memorial Mile to represent the U.S. service members who died in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
John Fornell is an associate member of Veterans for Peace in Madison. Each year on Memorial Day, the group sets up the Memorial Mile to represent the human cost of war. The tradition started in 2007, and except for a few pandemic pauses, has kept going. But it's not clear if the Memorial Mile can continue this or future years, under a proposed policy that would forbid all private art in parks. Fornell says the response from the city has been outside the norm, and he just recently found out about the proposal.
Every month or two, I keep contacting the Parks Commission, and it's like, well, just wait a minute, we're talking about it, blah, blah, blah. And finally, last month, we got a notice that there's going to be a discussion about art in the parks, and you are considered art in the parks.
Eric Knepp is the Madison Parks superintendent. He says it was his idea to put policy in place for private art displays in city parks.
Something we have not had and we really ought to have as a public entity. The policy essentially places it into the space of private art not being authorized in the city of Madison Parks generally, unless authorized through one of the two procedures that are incorporated, one of which is a part of a special event, or the second as a part of a relationship with the MAC, Madison Arts Commission.
And in cases where the display requires digging, like the Memorial Mile tombstones, the organizers would have to obtain approval. But Fornell takes issue with Memorial Mile even being defined as an art display in the first place.
It's a graphic display. It's not art. It's a memorial, just like a cemetery is a memorial. A cemetery is not an art display.
Knepp says that's too fine grain of a definition.
I don't believe we would create subsets of classifications of displays that are not contemplated as art and contemplated as temporary memorial or cemetery. The policy currently doesn't do that. As staff, we don't anticipate proposing such language.
Right now, the change is a proposal and hasn't taken effect. It's slated to head to a Board of Park Commissioners meeting on Wednesday evening. Fornell says he and other Veterans for Peace members plan to speak up at the meeting. According to Kelly Post, the city's park and street use supervisor, the city can't permit Memorial Mile until a policy is in place. She tells Fornell that because they're still in the early stages of the approval process, the Memorial Mile may not be able to take place this year. But Knepp says it's not entirely off the table.
There are definitely pathways for them to work with the city. I would not say it's definitively not happening or not possible, but I do not think it's possible in the way it has occurred before. For that specific event, I believe they have used some of the special event permitting in the past, and by definitions that are recognizable of what an event is, that is not what they are doing.
Fornell says the Memorial Mile is a valuable way of honoring the ultimate sacrifice.
You know, Memorial Day is not just a holiday where you can go in the park and drink beer. It should be something more than that, and that's what we're trying to do, make it a day of remembrance.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
On Sunday, Tyrol Basin had its annual pond skim to commemorate the end of this year's ski season. The result was a lot of wet skis, muddy ski boots, and a free Tyrol Basin season pass for one persistent snowboarder. Reporter Jess Miller was there to capture the action.
One of the many things this year's mild winter cut short was the Midwest ski and snowboard season. Sunday was the last day to ride the slopes at Tyrol Basin in Mount Horeb, which meant the ski hill held its annual pond skim roughly 2 weeks earlier than last year's event on March 26th. The premise is simple. Skiers or snowboarders go down a hill into a pond and attempt to skim to the other side without getting wet. The first person to do it successfully gets bragging rights and a free season pass. But the feat is easier said than done. Of the 24 or so people who attempted the skim over the course of the afternoon, only two made it across. The first was a snowboarder who claimed the free season pass on his second attempt, using a fishtail snowboard which he said helped get across the water. His strategy:
bomb the hill as fast as you can, and then just try to absorb the landing a little bit. Yeah, back weight on your back foot, yeah.
His success was followed immediately by a veteran pond skim skier.
Hey, my name is Brock Westby-Hess, and we're out here at the Tyrol pond skim, and I just skimmed across the pond and went point to point here, and yeah.
Yeah, is it your first time?
No, I've been doing this for years. I've made it across backwards before. You know, I'm a veteran out here at the pond skim.
How did you get into it?
I've just been at Tyrol, been working here since I was like 16, and you know, just all about the skiing environment. My parents got me started when I was like 2 or 3 years old. And just been doing it my whole life and love it. So,
cool.
You know.
What's the strategy?
So the strategy is speed and then like the right amount of leaning backwards, but not so far back that your skis are just going to, you know, slow you down in the water.
One skier who didn't fare as well was Connor Batten, who at least went into the water in style, dressed in a fur coat with no shirt underneath.
There's a lot of great people out here for this event. A lot of support there at the top of the mountain, encouraging people to go down. Unfortunately, for me, it involved losing both of my skis pretty early on in the water. So it's a good thing I had some bobbers out there. I lost my shades, but I didn't lose my skis.
Is that water cold?
It's a tad chilly. You know, I don't think it's meant to be to have people swimming in it in the month of March for sure.
Other costumes included cowboy hats and cut-off denim shorts, full cow suits, and plenty of brightly colored bathing suits. The day's sun and above-average temperatures at least made the process of drying off a little easier. For the even more daring, or those who figured that they were getting wet either way and wanted to make a show of it, a ramp at the bottom of the hill next to the pond made for some impressive jumps and delighted the 100 or so spectators gathered to watch and tailgate. For WORT News, I'm Jess Miller.
In just 3 weeks, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. Two candidates are vying for the District 20 seat, which represents the northeast corner of the county, containing the villages of Marshall and Morrisonville. Andrea Andrews is running against incumbent supervisor Jeff Weigand, and they'll face off on April 2nd. Earlier today, Andrews spoke to WORT News producer Faye Parks to discuss her priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, Andrea.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what inspired you to run for the Dane County Board?
Well, I've lived in Marshall for over 33 years, and I have raised my three kids here. I have served on the Village Board for the last 6 years, and my experience extends to various committees, including the Fire and EMS Commission, Planning Commission, Finance and Oversight Committee, and chairing the Building Committee, where I successfully spearheaded initiatives to construct a remodeled and new addition of our Village Hall and Police Station. I'm also very proud to be an active volunteer in my community, helping with our local food drives, and currently serving as Vice President of the Marshall Scholarship Foundation. Being exposed to different committees such as the Fire EMS, Planning Commission, and Finance and Oversight Committee have really given me a better opportunity to understand the role of local governance and how I can be an effective leader in my community.
So what are your priorities for District 20? What changes would you like to see there?
Well, since December, I have been out getting to know the constituents in District 20 and listening to their concerns to help me focus on what I should prioritize. And first and foremost is rural food insecurity. The Dane County Board has made tremendous efforts in helping with this growing issue, but in rural communities such as mine, I've seen the need continue to grow over the last 4 years, and we often face lower median incomes compared to our urban counterparts, leading to financial constraints that hinder access to affording an adequate food supply. Also, isolation poses a big challenge in my area in establishing and maintaining food assistance programs. Thankfully, there are these grassroots organizations like the Sunshine Place out of Sun Prairie and Do Good Wisconsin who have done some tremendous work in our community in bridging the gap, but these organizations need more help at the county level. A second priority is affordable housing choices, which ties into economic development. The demand for affordable housing has outpaced the supply, leading to various socioeconomic issues. And living in rural Dane County, a lot of our farmers are retiring and selling their land to developers. I hope to work with local municipalities in District 20 to incentivize these developers to build more housing choices in our area. Public safety is also a priority. Being a Village Board trustee, I recognize the challenges faced by local municipalities in funding public safety services within their budgets. To address this issue, I believe it's crucial to explore various solutions, including increasing state funding allocations for public safety, implementing regional collaboration and resource sharing agreements among neighboring municipalities, and exploring alternative revenue sources such as grants, partnerships with community organizations. I will be strongly advocating for policies at the state level that prioritize funding for public safety and provide adequate resources to local government. This may involve lobbying for changes to state funding formulas or advocating for increased flexibility in how municipalities can allocate funds to meet their public safety needs. Those are just a few of the priorities I'll be working on.
And do you have any priorities for the county as a whole? Anything you'd like to focus on?
Again, I know affordable housing is a priority for all of us in Dane County and food insecurity. I believe there was a study that was just done by St. Vincent de Paul this past weekend that showed the gap the last 4 years has grown between 112%. So there's definitely a need for the county to take note of what's happening and making sure that our food pantries are stocked so that people have resources to go to.
I know that criminal justice reform is also a big talking point this year. What is your perspective on that?
I firmly believe that our current system is in need of change to address issues of systemic inequality, racial disparities, and over-incarceration. And I support efforts to review and address disparities in sentencing, improve access to rehabilitation programs for nonviolent offenders, and prioritize alternatives to incarceration for low-level offenses. I believe in promoting transparency, accountability, and police reform to rebuild trust between law enforcement and local communities they serve. I also believe in promoting community policing initiatives and investing in mental health and substance abuse treatment programs to address underlying issues that contribute to criminal behavior. I will advocate for measured steps towards reform and prioritize public safety while ensuring fairness and accountability within the criminal justice system.
So, meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if elected to the county board, how do you plan to handle the transition?
Well, I admire all of the candidates that are running, Melissa, Dana, Wesley, and Regina. I think that by all accounts, they are very experienced and capable of holding this position. I think that whoever wins, as long as they uphold Dane County's mission to provide high quality and efficient public services, they will have a county board willing to take on any challenges with them. And I look forward to working alongside them.
And is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
This northeast side of Dane County is very special to me, and I would be honored to represent this district. I'm truly motivated by a deep commitment to community service and a genuine desire to contribute to the betterment of Dane County, and I recognize the pivotal role of local governance. I'm dedicated to fostering positive change and addressing pressing issues. And as a Hispanic female, I'm committed to being a voice for the underrepresented, ensuring a broad range of voices are heard in local decision-making.
Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me, Andrea.
Thank you.
That was Andrea Andrews, one of two candidates vying for the District 20 seat on the Dane County Board. District 20 covers the county's northeast corner, containing the villages of Marshall and Morrisonville. Andrews says, if elected to the Dane County Board, she will promote social programs and affordable housing in Dane County's smaller, outlying communities. On April 2nd, she'll face off with incumbent supervisor Jeff Wiegand.
The time right now is 6:33 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Jill Stein launched presidential bids in 2012 and 2016 on the Green Party ticket, and this year, the Green Party will appear on the presidential ballot. Dr. Stein is in Madison today on a 14-state tour. Tomorrow, she'll be in Racine and Milwaukee. She visited the WORT studio earlier today to speak with our news director, Shelley Pittman, and our news producer, Faye Parks.
And thanks for joining us, Dr. Stein. I see you're in front of us with a large notebook and many notes. Thanks for being here.
Yes.
So you're in Wisconsin today and tomorrow as part of a cross-country campaign tour. What's the reception been like in Madison and elsewhere in our state?
So we've only just arrived in Madison.
No, are we your first stop?
You actually are our first stop. We have talked to a few press virtually, but this is like the first face-to-face.
Well, welcome.
Yeah. Oh, it's very exciting. And I'd say, you know, Wisconsin is like the rest of the country, except more intense. And, you know, Wisconsin is kind of a symbol of our political system, which is that people flip back and forth looking for a political home that will actually provide them what they need instead of throwing them under the bus. But people keep getting thrown under the bus and aren't happy about it. So we're here to say there is another option here that is not, you know, under the direction of Wall Street and the war machine. And we are about delivering for everyday people. I must say, you know, with all humility, our agenda has been broadly adopted here by really any self-respecting progressive. It was the Greens who launched Medicare for All with Ralph Nader in the year 2000. My campaign launched free public higher education in 2012 and abolishing student debt, for which we were widely ridiculed at that time, a Green New Deal and recognizing the climate as the crisis that it is, but also the opportunity to really transform our economy and create, you know, the economic recovery program that we badly need at the same time that we reclaim the climate that we need to survive. So we have really put the actual issues of today on the agenda. You can add to that reparations as well, and also cutting the military budget so that it actually is a defense budget rather than an offense budget, which is not only endangering the world, destroying it before our very eyes, as we see with the genocide going on our iPhone screens and our computers, which is really a symbol of empire that's run amok, whose days really should be over. And, you know, the U.S. is continuing to try to be a unipolar power in a multipolar world. So as Greens, and as a candidate myself, over the years, we have been calling this like it is and advocating for the real changes that we need to put people back in charge of our future and our democracy and create the world that we deserve.
All right. Thank you for that answer. So as with, you know, you ran for president on the Green Party ticket several times before, and we're going to get into that. But you say in what you just said and elsewhere that you're running for president to offer people a choice outside the two-party system and to push for changes. Why is running for president the way to do that?
There are so many ways that this must be done. And running for president should not be left out. Let me put it that way. It's most important, you know, in my view, the real driver is the social movements out in the street. We have to do that. But if we only are fighting to stop genocide, to have affordable rents that aren't ripping people off, you know, 30% of their income, half of renters are now absolutely strapped on our rents. The water that's being polluted with, what is it, 70% or so of shallow wells in Wisconsin that have now been polluted with PFAS. There are so many issues we need to be fighting directly in the street and in the halls of power, but we must also contest for power. If we don't contest for power, then we can be written off. In the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. So contesting for power is part of this. As Greens, or really as any third party, we have to run also at highest levels of office in order to keep our ballot status to be able to run for all the other local offices. And by running at the national level, let me just say there is a void right now that will otherwise not be filled. We are the one pro-worker, anti-war, anti-genocide, and climate emergency campaign that can be and will be on the ballot to truly contest for power and to truly challenge empire and oligarchy. Barring our campaign, there is no other progressive campaign that is on track and that has the experience actually getting on the ballot so that we can bring these issues front and center in the election. And if they are not front and center, then we know how they are being decided. They are being decided, you know, by Joe Biden and Donald Trump and the parties of Warren Wall Street. So these issues will not be debated, and they certainly are not going to be fixed. But our days are numbered here, and it's very important to use them to the fullest extent. I would not rule out, you know, a black swan event here in this election, likewise, because voters have had it. They're done being thrown under the bus. They are done with the two parties that, you know, are serving business as usual, that do not offer health care as a human right, which would save us, by the way, $500 billion every year if we move to an improved Medicare for All system. They are not putting the solutions on the table. So because the American people are so hungry for this stuff, I wouldn't rule out that the many uncommitted voters out there right now could very well work their way to our campaign. In the recent primary in Michigan, we saw not only like 14% uncommitted, but we saw 50% of voters staying home relative to the last primary in 2020. So this is a perfect storm for political transition. People are really hungry right now, and I'd say hold on to your hat.
Let's do a little chronology. So you ran in 2012 and got about a quarter of a percentage point of the vote, or about 7,500 votes. And then in 2016, you got just over 1% of the vote, or about 31,000 votes. So that's during an election where Trump won Wisconsin by less than that margin at about 23,000 votes. And you have your share of critics who say that you pulled away Democratic votes in a state that narrowly elected Trump. That must be a common question, as that scenario could play out again this year. What's your response to that?
My response is that it is anti-democratic to suggest that voters do not have a right to vote for a candidate of their choice, and also that this is contrary to the facts to suggest that we, quote, took votes away. It's well established by polls, also to just by simply talking to people, that we did not take Clinton voters. Our votes as Greens, our votes came from people who otherwise would not come out to vote. So we draw from the not voting category. That category is bigger than ever. And I think that candidates or parties or advocates who suggest that your vote belongs to the Democrats or the Republicans for that matter, that alone disqualifies them, in my view, from deserving your vote, because your vote is not owned by anybody. Politicians have to earn your vote. They don't own your vote. And if they think they're entitled to it, that's a problem. And to my mind, that's a showstopper right there.
I want to follow up on that and push back a little bit on that. I'm sure that is the question, right? When you're asked on interviews, that is the question that you're asked. You know, you mentioned Wisconsin as a microcosm of the state of the nation right now. And there are some tough choices in Wisconsin where there are not ideal options. There are two options. Conversely, we're living in the longest election primary, because we already know the two main contenders for the two main Democratic and Republican parties. So why run this campaign in a battleground state in Wisconsin rather than in states that are otherwise solidly red or solidly blue to make that point?
I'd say try telling that to voters, that they don't have or deserve other choices than these two parties that have been throwing them under the bus. If you look at where Democrats lost the most votes, what was the most spoiled election ever? It was the midterms in 2010. What happened? Democrats lost 1,000 state rep seats. They lost 64 congressional seats, 13 Senate seats, and 12 governor seats. Was there a third party splitting that vote or taking those votes away? No, there was not. What happened was that the trifecta, the Democratic trifecta in Obama in the White House and two houses of Congress, decided to bail out Wall Street to the tune of trillions of dollars. massively opposed by voters, but they did that. They came up with that money in about a week's time against, you know, all indicators of what the public wanted. They did that, and as a consequence, you know, they did not bail out homeowners. They bailed out the perpetrators of the economic crash, and millions of people lost their homes. Prior to that, you had, you know, Clinton really closing the deal on NAFTA. So people are tired of what the Democrats bring to them. And I'd say if you want to tell them that there are only two choices in this country, I think they're going to tell you where you can go. I think voters deserve choices. Wisconsin is a case in point because it's not like it's Democrat or Republican. People don't like either. It's like which memory is most bitter, you know, in their minds that people are voting against. This is our election system. People don't vote for what they want. They're told you have to vote against what you hate and just settle for the lesser evil. But now the lesser evil is bombing four countries, taking serious risks with all of our lives, let alone our budget, because those four countries, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, were also bombing Iranian targets. And Iran happens to have a military agreement now with Russia. So this is inherently a nuclear conflict. And that $17 billion that Biden is trying to get out of Congress is not only to conduct genocide against the people of Gaza, it's also to expand the war in the Middle East. This is unbelievably dangerous. And we need more choices than this. This war is also not only this war, but this military madness, which consumes half of our budget, is directly responsible for why we don't have the money to be providing free public higher education or the affordable housing development that we need or health care. I mean, on a million fronts, there are things we're not doing because half of our budget is being consumed. You know, child poverty rates have doubled in the last year or so because the child tax deduction was basically decimated. So there are so many things we can do. We are paying a huge price for the reckless and criminal decisions being made by both political parties. The American people are demanding a better way forward. And it's not rocket science like that we can't do this. And that's why they try to silence us, keep us off the ballot, throw us off the ballot illegally, in fact, including here in Wisconsin, and lock us out of the debate because they are quaking in their boots. They know their days are numbered. Empire and oligarchy are truly teetering at the brink. American people are being crushed by inequality, by the climate crisis, the pollution of our food, water, and air, and so on. This is not a system that we are going to live in for very much longer, and the American people are chomping at the bit to take control of this promise of democracy and get to work.
Well, thank you so much for spending your time when you first come into Wisconsin here at WORT. Before we go, you're doing some stuff here in Wisconsin tonight in Madison. At the time of this airing, you'll be at the Cafe Coda from, I believe, 6 to 8 p.m. And then tomorrow you're headed to Racine. Tell me more.
Yeah, so tonight we're at Cafe Coda. Drop in if you can at 1224 Williamson Street in Madison. Tomorrow we are at a forum organized by Chester Todd, a long-term activist in the African-American community, running a forum on race in the community, a very critical issue here in Wisconsin, as all over the country. That will be at the DeCoven Center in Racine, and that's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we urge you to come on down and find out what your options are, because it's time to stop taking marching orders. It's time to stop being good little boys and girls, as we're all kind of collectively marched over the cliff here. And we think between 44 million young people and not so young trapped in student debt, 100 million locked into medical debt, 68% of the American public, according to a recent Reuters poll, I believe it was, who want a ceasefire now. We are going to be your choice that's on the ballot, and you may want to check us out sooner rather than later.
That was Green Party candidate Dr. Jill Stein sitting down with our news director, Sholly Pittman, and our news producer, Faye Parks. You can visit our website to hear the rest of their conversation.
Tomorrow, March 12th, is the anniversary of former President Truman's speech announcing the Truman Doctrine. This speech, before a joint session of Congress, is generally regarded as the start of the Cold War. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggled brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
Tomorrow, March 12th, is the anniversary of then-President Harry S. Truman's speech before a joint session of Congress, where he announced the Truman Doctrine. I believe it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by our minorities or by outside pressure. The year was 1947, and the speech marked the beginning of the Cold War. Its immediate impetus was to push through a Republican Congress a package of $400 million to aid the Civil War-ravaged Greece and Turkey. Less than 2 years after the devastation of World War II, the U.S. was emerging as a preeminent world power. It was also the only power to possess and use twice the nuclear bomb. By contrast, the Soviet Union suffered the most in the war, losing over 20 million people. In addition, it bore the brunt of the Nazi war machine. 80% of Germans killed in the war died fighting Russians. After taking such blows, it saw its loans from the U.S. end almost as soon as the guns stopped. People across much of the world scrounged and starved. In Truman's words, the British government, which has been helping Greece, can give no further financial or economic aid after March 31st. Great Britain finds itself under the necessity of reducing or liquidating its commitments in several parts of the world, including Greece. After the Germans abandoned Greece in October of 1944, the British invaded with 70,000 British and Indian troops to help retake Athens from the victorious communist-led National Liberation Front, EAM. The Brits and the Greek right-wing monarchist government engaged in several mass killings against largely unarmed EAM supporters. By 1947, there was a civil war, and Britain was broke and planned to withdraw its remaining 40,000 troops. The Greek communists received no help from Stalin, who had agreed that Greece was part of the Western Alliance, but obtained aid, despite Stalin's wishes, from Yugoslavia. Truman's aides warned him about falling dominoes in Greece and Turkey, spreading across Europe, that the U.S. must pick up where the British left off. To pass legislation in the Republican-controlled Congress, Truman met with his advisors and leading Republicans. Republican spokesperson Senator Arthur Vandenberg was convinced. Isolationist Howard Taft, not so much. Vandenberg advised Truman to address Congress and scare the hell out of the American people. The gambit won, and the bill passed both houses by a wide margin. $300 million was used by the Greek monarchists to overcome the EAM military resistance. $100 million in economic and military aid went to the Turks to overcome their own rebellion, and the U.S. Navy sent an aircraft carrier to maintain Turkish control over the straits. The Soviets had been pushing for joint control of the region on their common border. Arguably, the real reason for the interventions was to maintain a clear path for U.S. oil ships. One of Truman's advisors had wanted to make an indirect reference to that issue, but his lines were left out of the speech. Truman then sent massive aid to Europe. The Marshall Plan started on April 3, 1948, and provided $130 billion, but effectively excluded the Soviet Union and its allies. We are left to wonder how different our world might be if aid had gone to all who needed it. The U.S. in 1949 led the establishment of NATO, with an integrated army, including West Germany, greatly alarming the Soviet Union, whose foreign policy goals seemed limited to secure buffer states. The Chinese communists took power largely on their own, but Truman saw them as part of a global communist conspiracy. The Cold War policies led to U.S. involvement in Korea and Vietnam. Truman's foreign policy led to domestic suppression. Just 9 days after his speech, Truman issued the executive order for a loyalty investigation of 3 million federal employees. This encouraged the start of the October 1947 House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, and ultimately McCarthyism and the Second Red Scare. Meanwhile, Congress passed over Truman's veto, the Anti-Labor and Anti-Radical Taft-Hartley Act. But that is a story for another day. For the past is the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews a new sci-fi movie sequel based on Frank Herbert's book Dune. Harry says Dune Part 2 is even more exciting and entertaining than its predecessor. It features the same cast and the addition of a giant sandworm. Harry recommends watching it on the biggest screen you can find.
I see possible futures. all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
And that was a clip from the trailer for Dune Part 2. Like the prior installment, directed and co-script written by Denis Villeneuve. His co-script writer is again John Sprays. The movies are based on the great 1965 sci-fi classic Dune by Frank Herbert. This is a well-done action-adventure story with an A-list cast, fun special effects, and great cinematography by Craig Fraser. It was filmed partially at the World Heritage Site, Jordan's Wadi Rum in Abu Dhabi. Part 2 starts off where Part 1 ends, about halfway through Herbert's first book. You would enjoy Part 2 more if you saw Part 1 first and or read the first Dune book. Frank Herbert wrote 6 Dune books. I read the first 2 when they came out. His son Brian followed with 20 Dune books with Kevin J. Anderson. Dune Part 1 is streaming on several services. It is 2 hours 35 minutes long, so you may want to have some liquid refreshments and a snack handy. Okay, if you're still here and don't have the time to see Part 1 or read the first book, I'll try to summarize. Dune takes place in the far future, where starfaring humanity has developed faster-than-light travel but is run by evil, scheming Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, a great Christopher Walken. He is served by his planet-bound dukes. The jealous emperor has put the popular Duke Leto Atreides, Oscar Isaac, in charge of the desert world Dune, Arrakis, to the locals. Arrakis is vital to the Empire because it is the only place that has the spice, an addictive substance that allows Space Guild members to navigate the stars. There's also an influential, secretive, mystical women's sect, the Bene Gesserit, playing the long game. The Atreides have been set up to fail, but before they can do much more than unpack, they are ambushed and overcome by the armed forces of a rival duke, Vladimir Harkonnen, the always exceptional Stellan Skarsgård. The Harkonnens had grown rich oppressing Dune's indigenous people, the Fremen. At the end of Part 1, Harkonnen's army, including his brutal nephew Rabin, David Bautista, slaughter Duke Leto and retake the planet. The duke's consort, Lady Jessica, Rebecca Ferguson, a Bene Gesserit, and her son Paul, Timothy Chalamet, barely escape and are taken in by the Fremen. Part 2 begins with Paul and Jessica with the Fremen and still on the run. On the harsh desert world, the Fremen have adapted with a fairly egalitarian society and continue to resist the oppressive off-worlders. The Fremen cardinal rule is don't waste water. The Bene Gesserit have spread their members and legends across many worlds, including Arrakis. Many Fremen, including the local resistance leader Stilgar, Javier Bardem, believe Paul is their prophesied off-world savior. On the other side are warriors like Johnny, Zendaya. Though she and Paul share a mutual attraction, Johnny believes only the Fremen can free the Fremen. Paul is conflicted, but as he learns the Fremen ways and becomes addicted to the spice, he sees the many possible futures. Paul, as part of his initiation, rides one of the planet's giant sandworms, one of the film's most stirring scenes. Paul is soon joining raids to sabotage Harkonnen spice mining machines. The movie makes some significant changes from the book, especially around the relationship between Paul and Johnny. Most importantly for the story might be the up-in-air Holy War ending that sets up Part 3. The most disappointing change from the book is the lack of Arabic, Bedouin, or other Middle Eastern members of the cast, and the watered-down, no pun intended, religious cultural influences used so effectively by Herbert. Critiquing the first film, Dr. Ali Karjo Ravari, assistant professor of Islamic studies at Pennsylvania's Bucknell University, noted, "The absence of the word jihad obfuscates Herbert's deliberate characterizations of the Fremen, whose identity Karjo Ravari describes as some future variety of Islam and Arab, adding that if it was real and people saw it today, they'd call it Islam. But with that criticism firmly in mind, I still recommend the film and look forward to seeing Dune 3. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Jess Miller was your reporter. Your feature contributor was Harry Richardson. Thanks also to Nicholas Leap for technical production and Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Have a great night.